This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. The Mafi Marmara survivors will be heard, and Israel's blockade of Gaza must be completely lifted.
Ask me how it is that I dare to take a side. You say I loathe myself, pointing out you have lied. You say it's tribal warfare, but I disagree, for the dynamics of the situation are not difficult to see. On the one side is the fighter jet, on the other is the stone. On the one side is the slave, on the other is the throne. For the many there are checkpoints, while foreign soldiers rule the streets. For the one side there is victory, but the people don't accept defeat. The word you need to know is occupation.
Indeed, the word is occupation. 3 weeks ago, Israeli naval commander stormed a Turkish ship loaded with humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza. They murdered 9 unarmed passengers. The oldest, Ibrahim Bilgin, was 61. The youngest, Furkan Dogan, a U.S. citizen born in Troy, New York, was just 19. Kevin Ovingdon, international organizer working to break the blockade of Gaza, was an eyewitness to this horror and spoke at a packed meeting in Brooklyn's historic House of the Lord Pentecostal Church, pastored by the Reverend Herbert Daughtry. But that was despite efforts by City Council Speaker Christine Quinn, Representatives Gerald Nadler, Anthony Weiner, Carolyn Maloney, Charles Rangel, and Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer to silence their voices.
On June 14th, these public officials gathered in Times Square at the behest of the Jewish Community Relations Council and shamelessly demanded that the State Department investigate Kevin Ovingdon and the other invited speakers for ties to terrorism.
Another witness to the atrocity, a former Turkish parliament member and human rights activist, Ahmet Faruk Unsal, was not allowed to board a plane from Turkey to join the event at the House of the Lord Church.
This is a clear attempt to not only deny the passengers' right to speak, but to deny the people of the United States the right to hear their words.
Which we are going to hear right now.
My name is Herb Daughtry. I want to welcome you to the House of the Lord. You were here last year as we helped to pack the supplies that went overland to Gaza. So you are at home. If you feel the Spirit moving, feel a sense of leaving here and continuing the struggle, if you feel a sense that you're on the right road and we're going to continue to supply the Palestinians, we're going to continue this struggle, if you feel that, in fact, what you feel is the ghost of the great freedom fighters of yesteryear. You are at home. God bless you and continue the struggle. Viva Palestina! Long live! The freedom struggle is everywhere! Long live justice everywhere! May we all be free and enjoy human rights and self-determination for all the peoples of the world! I want to welcome this Brother Ovingdon.
Great thanks to Reverend Daughtry for inviting us back here again. After the British Empire murdered Irish freedom fighters, strapping people who were wounded already to a chair in order to execute them following the Easter Rising of 1916. The great poet William Butler Yeats wrote, "All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born." Today we might add to the second part, the couplet, "A new phase of struggle is born, but at a terrible, almost unbearable price. 9 brothers taken from us aboard the Mavi Marmara. Dozens more wounded by gunshots to the head, to the abdomen, and to the limbs. Their blood is now lapping on the shores of Gaza. But their blood was not shed in vain, because the tide has turned, and we must seize this tide to make a lasting change for the people of Palestine, the Middle East, and around the world. I remembered them on the Monday nights after the assault, bound in an Israeli dungeon in the Negev Desert. I remembered the brother who was shot through the leg, just 1 meter in front of me. The one shot through the abdomen, 50 centimetres to the right of me. Where we were, there were no Israeli commandos within the immediate proximity. It is simply unfeasible for anyone to maintain that the people who fired those shots from above, not within our line of sight, in any sense could feel threatened by the two men who were shot either side of me. It was a complete and utter lie. It's also a lie in the shooting dead of Cevdet Kılıçlar, a young man who left a wife and two children, a photographer. He was holding a stills camera. Again, not one Israeli commando within the immediate vicinity, but he was shot through the forehead, the high-velocity bullets blowing away the back third of his skull, cradled by a friend of mine, Nikki Enchmarch, as the last few seconds of his life passed away. And many, many more testimonies can come forward. It is not evidence, of course, that will be marshalled in the Israeli so-called impartial inquiry, which they've launched and to which the United Nations Security Council, the United States and Britain have acquiesced. A whitewash inquiry. And there will be legal actions in many jurisdictions around the world, and a truly independent tribunal that the Emir of Qatar has publicly stated that he will underwrite all legal actions, civil and criminal, against the Israeli state over these atrocities. But you know, the thing about whitewashes is that if you slap whitewash on too thick and too quick, it begins to peel as soon as you put it on. The British establishment has just found this out. 38 years ago, they commissioned a shotgun inquiry into the Bloody Sunday massacres, which killed 14 people, the Widgery whitewash, and it's just been overturned by the Savile inquiry, and the truth is out. Justice will not be denied forever. The tide has turned. This is the meaning of the massacre of the Mavi Marmara. It is that the miasma of defeat, which had settled for so long in the minds of people throughout the Middle East and even upon many of our own minds in this room tonight, is finally lifting. And we can see how we can start to take some steps forward to victory. The question is not, will this siege be lifted? The question is how rapidly it will take and how this siege will be ended. I was with some of the families of the 9 people who were murdered. Some of them, we travelled together in December of last year and January of this on the last land convoy, which doubled in number as we crossed from Greece into Turkey. A crossing which brought friendship between people on both sides of a disputed border. The relatives of those who fell were very, very clear. Israel is attempting to terrorize not only the Palestinian people, but all of those who stand with them. But we are not afraid today. We will not be afraid in the future missions which are coming soon, about which I want to say something about in a second part of the speech, but because of the enforced absence of our friend from Turkey, an outrageously enforced absence of our friend from Turkey, I'm going to have to speak again towards the end and address those questions. But we need now to think strategically. The daily deaths and humiliations of the Palestinian people have not been the cause of the level of outrage at the deaths of the 9 people aboard the Mavi Marmara. But sometimes history works in this way. 36 years ago, 2 young Jewish civil rights activists from New York headed south, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, to find themselves murdered alongside a local activist, the black man James Cheney, in Mississippi on June 21st, 1964. It was a grievous loss, but it served as a turning point in the civil rights movement and the wider movement for black liberation. And I believe that turning point is upon us now on the path to liberation in Palestine. Our enemies are on the back foot, but they're running fast to try to get back onto the front foot, and we must understand what they're trying to do. They're attempting to isolate, to denigrate the government of Turkey, the people of Turkey, and in particular the magnificent civil society organisation, the İHA. And we, as an international movement, cannot allow the Turkish movement to be so isolated. We must refute the idea that murders took place aboard the Mavi Marmara were the fault of those of us, particularly the Turkish brothers and sisters, who were aboard the Mavi Marmara. The most absurd justifications are coming out. You read that Israeli commandos faced a lynch mob, but this must be the first lynch mob in which the victims pursued the aggressor in order to defend themselves from the aggressor's violence. The victims of lethal violence have an absolute right to collectively defend themselves with their bare hands and with whatever lies to hand. I'm minded of what Malcolm might have said about this. Perhaps he might have said, "We didn't land on Israel, Israel landed on us." Across the world, all those who've been moved by this issue need to step into the front rank of the movement alongside those in Turkey who've lost their loved ones. From all four points of the compass, we must mobilise now to head back to Gaza and through Gaza towards the liberation of Palestine as a whole. This is the Sharpeville and the Soweto of the movement of solidarity with the Palestinian people, not of the Palestinians themselves. For the Palestinians have seen more and more massive massacres than that which took place aboard the Mavi Marmara. From Deir Yassin, through Black September, through Sabra and Shatila, through the assaults, the atrocities against the people of Gaza 18 months ago. Not of the Palestinians, but of the movement of those who stand with them, the Sharpeville and the Soweto. And we must remember and treasure the lessons of the great struggle against apartheid. There was a time when apartheid seemed invulnerable, a time when it would say it did not care about UN security resolutions, just as Israel does today, a time when it said that it did not care about any government's attitude, provided it continued to have the support of the United States of America, or at least its government, just like Israel does today. But that was progressively broken down. Apartheid in South Africa was isolated from without and undermined from within. A crucial step now is to open ourselves wider to new forces who are perhaps looking at this question for the first time, people who've been moved as never before by the atrocities on the Mavi Marmara. There was a very important article in the New York Review of Books, the survey of opinion of young Jewish people in the United States of America. It found an increasing number who do not have a blank check for Israel, but hold Israel to the same universal standards of behaviour that everybody else should be held to. This is an important step forward. There will be others asking, how is it that every year the White House's billions of dollars of subventions to the State of Israel are voted through by the Congress to pay for the weapons, the five bullets that were fired into the body of Furkan Doğan, an American citizen? What is in it for the average citizen in the United States of America to pay a foreign power to kill your own citizens? These are questions we must encourage other people to ask, and we should have no fear about how far and wide this movement can go. The attempts to silence and intimidate are weakening. A journalist asked me before this meeting, was I concerned about the protest outside? I said, what protest? I couldn't see a protest for the flood of people who were coming in. My friend and comrade George Galloway was speaking in Dallas on the night of the massacre of the Mavi Marmara. 1,200 people turned up. These are the numbers that we should think now. And if we can change the public opinion above all here, we cannot just be a movement of activists. We must become a movement of people, a movement of the mass democratic forces in this country and in the Middle East that have the key to liberate the people of Palestine. Remember, the apartheid abomination could murder 69 people in Sharpeville. It could gun down Hector Peterson and hundreds of school students in Soweto. It could torture and execute our prince, Steve Biko. It could assassinate our lion, Chris Hani. But the giant Mandela did walk free. Apartheid did fall. Gaza will be liberated. The siege will be lifted. The apartheid wall will fall. Together, to Gaza, through Gaza, to a Palestine, free, sovereign, dignified, at al-Nasr, at al-Quds. In the prison in Be'er Sheva, we had some time to think. We were mournful and angry, but also, perhaps strangely, calm and confident, because we knew that around the world, people would respond. The second thing we knew is that the political capital that Israel has had in the bank has been withering for many years. You see, there was a time, 40 years ago, when even many, if not most, people who would describe themselves as progressive would think of the state of Israel as some social democratic paradise in the eastern Mediterranean, with the kibbutzim as some kind of socialistic phenomenon. A Sweden amongst a sea of backward and feudal Arabs was the way that most of the mentality was. That time has long gone. The people who could carry off that square circle of socialist Zionism are long gone, to be replaced by the ugly reality of Benjamin Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman. And they're not attractive, even for many people in Israel, let alone elsewhere in the world. And in the last 4 years, the decline has been even more rapid. First, the assault on the people of Lebanon ended in military and political defeat for the Israeli government. The assault on the people of Gaza ended in political defeat for the invading forces. It gave rise to a wider movement than ever before. And this later massacre, again, has devalued Israel's currency in the world. And it's that, strategically, which opens up the possibility for further action. And truly a big step forward in the movement, one which I'm convinced can achieve the decisive, immediate objective of the full lifting of the siege on the people of Gaza. Already, they're forced to try to redefine the siege. The Israeli government announced it was going to allow more goods in. What they say they'll allow in now that have not been allowed in for 4 years. Children's toys are some of them. But the construction goods, and above all, the free movement of people and of goods and of capital, which is critical for the development of Gaza and Palestine as a free and independent entity, is something that they're not prepared to happen. And we need to give a clear answer that nothing less than the full lifting of the siege will do. Anything else is a redefining of the prison. This siege is tottering, and Gaza is crucial strategically, not because it's the only injustice that the Palestinians face. The West Bank, the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem, the conditions in the camps, the very existence of the refugees, all stand in their own rights as unacceptable injustices. But it's strategically important because the other side made it strategically important in 2006. By isolating Gaza, they hoped to strangle the fighting spirit of the Palestinian resistance by isolating Hamas, who are the people who were chosen in a free and fair election by the Palestinian people. Therefore, the road to redeveloping a Palestinian unity, That road lies through the immediate objective of lifting the siege on Gaza, and various things, I think, flow from that tactically. The cutting edge of this movement, which has been the delivery of humanitarian aid in defiance of the restrictions via land and via sea, absolutely has to continue, and continue in bigger numbers, and continue with greater coordination. By land, heading through Egypt, the border at Rafah is an Arab-Arab border. If the Rafah crossing was completely open, Israel could whistle in the wind. There would be no effective siege on the people of Gaza. Pressure needs to be brought to bear upon those governments in the region who are complicit in the attempt to isolate the people of Gaza. Viva Palestina will be leading, in conjunction with partners, the biggest land convoy yet, leaving London around the 12th of September, from London through France, Italy, Greece, into Turkey, through the Near East, down to Jordan, into the Sinai, and up to Rafah, aiming to take the construction materials and to open up the lines of trade and freedom of movement which the Palestinian people more generally need. This will be done in conjunction with a consortium of organisations to bring together simultaneously, travelling through the Mediterranean, like the land convoy, picking up support from the North Atlantic coast of Morocco all the way through to Egypt and to the seaport of Gaza, the biggest flotilla yet, leaving simultaneously, aiming to be offshore as we go in through land. This we offer to you, and I ask to consider how an American, a New York City, New York State component to both the land convoy and the flotilla could be formed, could be fundraised for, in order to make that possible. We're talking 13 weeks. We need to move very quickly to seize this moment. Secondly, in reference to the struggle against apartheid, there came a time by the mid-late 1980s where no self-respecting person, leaving aside the racist right, would regard the apartheid regime as a regime with which you should have normal relations, sporting, cultural, academic, through trade, or in any other way. And this movement to boycott and isolate the Israeli regime is growing and is in a position now to take a big step forward. There needs to be, internationally, an authoritative call from a representative body to clearly identify the focus for that boycott. You see, the way I'd put it is this. I went to university in the mid-1980s, and not a lot of us knew about the full extent of the connections between British big business and apartheid. But what everybody was told was that you don't buy Outspan fruit and you don't bank with Barclays Bank. These were two iconic parts of the boycott behind which people could be introduced to all the other aspects of it. And we need some iconic elements which can focus this feeling. This, in turn, can generate much more wide and collective action. In Britain, the trade union movement has recently passed policies moving towards the boycott of at least some Israeli products, principally those that are illegally produced on the West Bank. It's a very important step forward. And in 1985... a young Irish shop worker called Mary Manning received just such a policy document from her union in Ireland, which said that the union was boycotting various South African goods. So when a customer turned up with an Outspan grapefruit, Mary Manning told her at Dunn's store that she could not check the fruit out because it was being boycotted. Mary Manning was sacked. Her 10 workmates walked out in her support. It became a cause célèbre internationally, which spurred on collective labour movement action against apartheid. If we can popularise this idea, there are many, many Mary Mannings out there who may be prepared to take that step. There are certainly people who will be prepared to boycott and to collectively go into supermarkets and so on, selling Israeli produce in order to make protest. Dock workers in San Francisco and their supporters are going to, for one day, follow the example of dock workers in Durban and in Sweden and refuse to unload an Israeli ship in San Francisco. these different levels of the movement, which ultimately led to even recalcitrant politicians saying that they too would break links with apartheid South Africa, can mutually reinforce one another. The high-profile, cutting-edge, direct engagement against the siege by land and sea, the widespread consumer boycott backed by systematically refuting every lie that comes out of the Zionist propaganda machine, encouraging the collective action at the points at which the Israeli economy can be squeezed. These different interlocking elements are what we can begin to look forward to advancing widely. I started with a quote from William Butler Yeats. Let me end with one from another Irish national fighter, Patrick Pearse, who spoke at a memorial meeting on the eve of the First World War in this very city. And he said, "There can be no peace between truth and falsehood, between tyranny and justice, between freedom and oppression. There can only be eternal struggle between them until justice is won and freedom prevails. This is what we need to have inscribed on what we're doing now. Nothing short of justice and freedom is acceptable, because without justice and freedom, there will not be peace in Palestine. If there's not peace in Palestine, there will not be peace in the wider Middle East. If there is no peace, but instead a wider threat of greater war in the Middle East, then there will be no peace in the world."
And you've been listening to international organizer to break the blockade against Gaza and to establish a free, free Palestine, Kevin Ovington, as he spoke last week, despite the fact that a number of our elected officials try to prevent it. Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.